You're listening to a Comics XF podcast.
Matt Lazowitz, and welcome to this week's episode of Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast, where each week my co-host Will Nevin and I dig into three Batman stories, discuss them, and rank them on the big board, thus creating a giant list of Batman stories from best to worst. Will, how's it going tonight?
I'm doing all right. I'm dealing with some kind of head cold bullshit. So it's got a head full of snot. From the Department of Corrections and Retractions. First of all, it's a correction. Clarification, more like. I don't retract anything. I will bend reality to my whim. Last week's episode, we're talking about the Folio Society's Batman book. And Matt here wisely points out, hey, why the fuck is Batman not number one not in this thing? And I'm the whole time staring at this list and like, this is a list of 11 stories. 11 stories is fucking weird. Turns out the 12th story is indeed Batman number one, but it's a little flippity floppy.
Insert
copy replica edition that I'm sure won't confound novice collectors 20 years from now. It's a strange project. I don't know who it's for, but you know what? I don't have to write copy for the Folio Society, and I don't have to sell books for them, and I don't have to do either of those things for DC. So you guys enjoy. Good luck. Second, and this will flow into tonight's discussions. I have an idea for a new tier of backer, Matt. I think this should be the Bruce Wayne tier. Bruce Wayne being the first Robin, I think if you want to pick a book that is not available digitally, meaning that either I have to go out and buy a physical copy or I have to slum with the goddamn pirate sites yet again, I think it should cost you extra money. So I'm thinking of benefits, right? And look, I don't know the Patreon rules, right? I'm willing to offer sexual favors, but again, I don't know if we can put that on the official document.
Also, in all fairness, as one of the Patreon backers is your wife, I think we might not want to lose the one Patreon backer. Just saying.
Or look, maybe she's got to go to a higher tier, right?
I will say, if you have to deal with those pirate sites, best thing in the world I discovered for that, Chrome tablet, because these suckers, if this gets infected with anything, just one click, reset to factory settings, goodbye malware.
And I also found that it works better if you just do like one scrolling page without having to click through. That was a new thing I tried this time around. It was much, much less irritating. But then I was stuck reading a book on PC, and that's a scary place I don't want to be in.
You've been doing it one page at a time on the bootleg sites? You are a madman.
I read my comics as they were intended, one page at a time. I don't do the panel view on, you know, what used to be Comixology.
It's like seven pop-ups per page.
I know, right? That's why I was so goddamn frustrated.
Or like 154 of the fucking things. Like, why do you do this to yourself?
This is why I as well have always used the Webtoons model of the continuous scrolling page. But
that's not what Danny O'Neill wanted when we were trying to read one of his stories.
But fuck knows what Danny O'Neill wanted in that story. And look, if I had known the quality of that book we all had to purchase individually, we would maybe only be covering two stories this week.
We would have found there were third options. And I'll be honest, that one was the one I was the most like, I honestly did not remember that. Oh, by the way, everybody, Josh Wheel's back. Hey, Josh.
That's who that is.
Yeah, no, that was a boy. But that is the last story of the night. We have considerably more enjoyable material before then to discuss.
So what's our theme for tonight, boys?
Well, Josh is back, and Josh is bringing with him his boy, his favorite, Ollie Queen, the Green Arrow, circling back to three more Batman Green Arrow stories.
And we'll start with one that we actually talked about last week.
Because it is indeed in that Folio Society, 12 greatest, most influential, most...
12 Batman stories.
You're spoiling it for the crowd. Now they know that it's going to be in the top 12 at the end of this.
Well, as we discussed last week, that Folio Society book is very feels like volume one of two, since it ends in 1993. It's like it ends with Nightfall Part One. So not the first Morrison issue, not the first Snyder issue, nothing since 1993. But
can I do the title for this one? Because I feel like it needs some emphasis.
Will, follow your heart.
It's Batman, Brave and the Bold, number 85. The Senator has been shot!
This is written by Bob Haney, with pencils by Neil Adams, inks by Dick Giordano, penciled by Ben Oda, and edited by Murray Baltanoff. The cover date is September of 1969. Senator Paul Cathcart has been shot, and the important anti-crime bill he has been championing is in danger. The governor has chosen Bruce Wayne to take his place to make sure the bill passes, and Bruce must decide if his obligations as Batman are more important than this honor. Meanwhile, Oliver Queen is wrestling with whether being Green Arrow matters anymore. The two heroes face these crossroads as they attempt to stop gangster Mr. Minotaur from killing them both.
This is the second story we've read where Batman has been championing a very important anti-crime bill. What was that first one?
It was the story paired with The Silent Night of Batman.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to remember the name of that story. Death Casts the Deciding Vote.
Yes, there we go.
Yes.
And I couldn't help but think this entire time, there has never been an unpopular anti-crime bill. Never in the history of American politics has there been, at least when it's being discussed, there has never been any senator, any representative who stands up and says, "Today, gentlemen, I rise to speak on behalf of crime. We have long been too hard on crime.
And this
will be an injustice."
This is so divisive that it literally, because this is in the Senate, has to come down to a 50-50 vote. Because that's the only way that if Bruce doesn't show up, this bill fails. Because it's got to come down to, you need all 50, and you have to have the VP to sign off on it.
Well, I do love it works that Wayne with a W is last in alphabetical order.
Well, what the book doesn't explain is that really this was a cloture vote, and you needed 60 senators. So that's what it really was.
Oh,
there was a slight hand waving of parliamentary procedure here.
This is a Bob Haney comic. It is all hand waves. That is what Bob Haney does. Whether it is parliamentary procedure, continuity, anything, Bob Haney will hand wave away whatever to tell his story. And I do not say that as a bad thing, because I love a Bob Haney story. And we've covered a bunch of these Brave and the Bolds. I think this one is my favorite of the lot that we've gotten to so far.
I'm so happy you said that, because I was going to say that too. I was worried that I was going to be too optimistic on it. I thought that this was probably the best of those Brave and the Bold stories.
Apparently other people think so too.
Beautiful art. I really like that, we skipped the unnecessary confusion where the heroes have to fight each other first. A little less of a trifle with the villains in the overall plot. I thought it, got in and out, solid story, 20 pages or so, and I dug it.
And on top of that, as you said, the art is gorgeous. And this is Neil Adams at the top of his game. Like, we're just a little bit before Hard Travel and Heroes. But more than that, the Dick Giordano inks. Giordano is one of those guys who, man, you let Giordano ink your book, no matter how good a penciler you are, he just boosts it just that little bit. Jim Aparo looks great with Mike DiCarlo inks, with any number of inkers, but Aparo Giordano was always a step above. And I think that that's another thing we get here, just how good this book looks.
This one exceeded my expectations going in. They say the only groan came on the final page with the self-inflicted hypnosis line. But honestly, I thought it's way better than the trope we always complain about. If you know Batman's identity, you have to die.
So the distinguished senator from Gotham State, champion of
New Jersey, baby, woo!
His son is psychiatrist, and both of these men, Batman and Green Arrow, confide in him their secret identities. And Batman says, aha, I know I can trust you because of patient doctor confidentiality. I'm like, you really don't have that relationship? And you know, I mean, that's not like a blood oath. That's just an ethical, you know, requirement. And you're not his patient.
No, they're at the gym working out.
Yeah. I wouldn't put my entire future on that.
Again, Bob Haney has only the loosest understanding about how any of this works. It's like when you get to the end, when Oliver finally catches Mr. Minotaur, it really felt like, hey, kids, you know how embassies work? Let me tell you how embassies work.
This is like the great reverse diplomatic immunity, right? Aha, we only got you because you're at the American embassy. Surprise.
And it's also like, wait, he's in Greece. I don't think Greece is a non-extradition country. And the dude is an American citizen.
Yeah. What do you think this is, Markovia?
Exactly. It's wild. And I love it. I loved how just this was bonkers and delightful at the same time. Batman and Green Arrow both happen to be, you know, suffering these sort of simultaneous crises of faith. And I really have this feeling like this book was written somewhat Marvel style, like plot first. Because when you look at page 5, it really feels like a lot of the dialogue there was sort of, oh crap, this doesn't line up with how I planned it. This doesn't quite match the art. The dialogue, my other identity as Green Arrow, I'd almost forgotten it. It's been some time, like something from another life, while he's donning the Green Arrow costume. Why is he putting on the costume? And then,
oh, this is the first appearance of Green Arrow with the beard and other things. It's the first post Robin Hood-ish looking Ollie.
Absolutely. It is the dawn of the Errol Flynn goatee. I think that's why it made that Brave and the Bold, that folio edition, because it is a really significant Brave and the Bold. And then later on the same page, like, what? They're not here. Munson took the plans. You don't see Oliver looking for the plans. He's off panel. It's just a random thought bubble. It absolutely felt like one of these Marvel books that you'd see from this same era where Stan, or sometimes, I mean, this is what broke up the Claremont and Byrne team, is Byrne would draw something and then Claremont would just have dialogue that didn't really match Byrne's intention. And Byrne, being a jackass, just took his baseball and went home.
That tracks.
Dave Cockrum was a better human being anyway.
Oh, John Byrne.
Yeah, fortunately, there's very little John Byrne Batman, like 2 or 3 stories. We won't have to have too much problematic creator watch on him.
But he does have those weird Star Trek photo things.
Yes.
Have you read any of those?
No. I've read a lot of them.
Me too.
Oh, really? Okay, I might have to check that out.
That's probably the second worst book I'm gonna admit to reading, the first being all the crossed books I read.
You read a bunch of Xenoscope for the site. That's gotta be
Which Xenoscope did you read?
Just absolutely just the anthology books, the horror anthology. I am not screwing around with those fairy tales. And yes, some of them were bad, but look, if I'm reading a horror anthology, especially from like a D-list publisher, I expect cheese. I expect, oh, this is real dumb. I have zero expectations. But when Garth Ennis is, you know, writing a zombie book, I expect it to have some kind of standards, and Cross has zero standards.
I read one arc of a Xenoscope book. It was in late 2011, early 2012. And I can tell you this because I know exactly why I read it. I was so fucking pissed off at the Green Arrow New 52 that I was, it's the only Green Arrow single issue comics I don't own, that I was like, fuck this. I'm like, I picked up they had a new Robin Hood Xenoscope book. And I'm like, they picked up the first issue and I'm like, this is better than New 52 Green Arrow. This,
yikes.
Which is true. And I read that, the first arc of that.
And this I give Adams credit for. There's a bit of business on page 8 of this issue that is pure art. I do not imagine this was in the script when Bruce is indeed talking with the younger Edmund Cathcart, the son. And they are working out. And after he's revealed that he's Batman, he just picks up this barbell and he just, you see him lifting it with ease. And then the next panel, you see these big muscle guy like struggling with it in the background while they're talking. And it's just a beautiful bit of physical comedy that I feel like was just Adams working in a little something in the background. And it's so nice, that attention to detail and just those little hints.
I still cannot believe Batman going up to this guy and be like, yo, dog, I'm Batman.
And then the next day, Oliver Queen going up to him being like, by the way, I'm Green Arrow.
And he does not mention the doctor-patient confidentiality. He's just like, yeah, I'm Green Arrow, dog. What's up?
I could just be like, am I wearing a sign? Please divulge your secret identity. Of course, in our big bad Mr. Minotaur, who I guess they decided to call him that because there's the, you know, labyrinth under his island that the boat goes through. But I would have expected more of a bull theme or more Greek mythology stuff with calling him Mr. Minotaur, but
it had me thinking or trying to remember. I'm like, oh, is this, wait, this is all so familiar. Like, this is a character I've seen like reused since then. And then I remembered, no, I was thinking of the shitty businessman from Jason Aaron's Thor run.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Also a Minotaur.
Yes, yes, who absolutely becomes a Minotaur man by the end. But I don't think we've actually talked too much about the plot of this story.
The senator was shot, Matt. I mean, what else do we need?
The senator was shot. Bruce Wayne has to be the senator. Ollie is competing in business with Mr. Minotaur to build a second Gotham over a landfill, like that episode of The Simpsons where Springfield moves because all the garbage is overtaking the town.
It's called Staten Island.
Oh, that's a sick burn on you, Staten Island.
And Batman and Green Arrow have to team up after Edmund is kidnapped by Mr. Minotaur to get information on Bruce Wayne and Oliver Queen to blackmail them, which they don't get. It's a Bob Haney script. I mean, they're all really, or plot, they're all really A to B to C, wacky. Let's not pay too much attention to the details. That's how you get Donna Troy stories. And the devil in a Bob Haney story is in the details. It's in just how wild he gets or how committed he is to the bit.
Well, and I think what makes this stand out against the other is he's a little more reined in with the wild, and the art is fantastic. So, I mean, that combination just, it makes it go down a lot smoother.
Yeah. As much as it feels like he might not get all the details of the things he's working on, nowhere do you get Granny Goodness and a youth serum or the demon Etrigan turning into a mongoose to kill a snake wizard.
Those are books that I read. Those are books that we discussed. I still think you're making it up.
And there's more character, it feels like, here. Oh, and wait, we also, the other, we did one other Haney and Adams, the one with the League of Assassins and Boston Brand possessing his brother Cleveland Brand. Let's not forget that one. But this one, it feels like there's more character stakes because of the stuff that he's doing with Oliver and having him think about being Green Arrow. I would have to go back and look at the last time Ollie was in Brave and the Bold before this. And I think it had been a while. I think Oliver had been on the shelf. He'd been in Justice League, but I don't think he'd been solo in a long time. And as you, just for the creation of the iconic Green Arrow look, this issue is important. I think I'm good.
That silence suggests that it's time, but the senator has been shot. Batman Brave the Bold number 85 on the big board.
Hey, we have 381 stories on the big board.
Ooh boy.
Number one is the post-crisis origin of Batman, Batman Year One.
Still. At a sexy 69 is JLA Prometheus.
At 100 is Made of Wood, the Batman Golden Age Green Lantern team up. At 200 is Fever, the first appearance of the ventriloquist in Scarface. At 300 is Doorway to Nightmare, the Flash Nightwing team up. And 381. Is War Crimes.
Nominative determinism.
All right. So the highest Brave and the Bold that we have is at 272. This is well above that.
That would be Hour of the Serpent.
Yeah.
My opening pitch was going to be Blade's territory around 217.
Yeah, I was gonna say I think this falls. I was gonna put it somewhere in the 200, somewhere around 200.
Death Casts the Deciding Vote is at 242, which is a similar story as we talked about in the open. I think this is better.
Yeah.
Heart of Hush is 227.
Oh, better. I don't think it beats Blades at 217, but at the same time, I also think Blades is one that will be re-ranked, so there is some flexibility there.
I like the Night of the Monster Men crossover at 214 a lot better.
I think, as we have said, Double Talk at 225 is good until the end where it falls apart because of puppet fucking. And this doesn't fall apart at the end.
No puppets were fucked in this story.
No.
Not a single puppet got fucked.
And despite that last panel with the self-hypnosis being a little weird, that is still leaps and bounds better than puppet fucking.
And look, at least we just got one panel of that, right? We didn't get a whole explanation of how he was going to self-hypnotize or him debating on whether to self-hypnotize into a racist brain.
So, puts it above 220. So if we're saying below Blades and above that, that's between 217 and
I liked it better than Adventure Continues at 223, May or Mayhem.
Yeah.
More historically significant probably than Legend of the Bat might fall at 222, but about the same in terms of content. So I'd make this the new Triple Deuce.
I think that's good. Our second story of the night is Fables. This is Detective Comics, Volume 1, Annual Number 1, Green Arrow, Volume 2, Annual Number 1, and The Question, Volume 1, Annual Number 1. The story is written by Denny O'Neill, with pencils by Klaus Janson, Tom Artis, and Dennis Cowan, inks by Tony DiZuniga, Tim Zahn, and Rick Magyar. Colors by Adrian Roy, Julia Laquement, and Tatiana Wood. Letters by Todd Klein and Steve Haney, and edited by Mike Gold. The cover dates are September to October of 1988. Lady Shiva escorts the martial arts master Osensei to three warriors, Batman, Green Arrow, and The Question, to get their aid in bringing him to be buried beside his wife. Along the way, each hero will learn something from the master and come changed from the experience.
Little trivia fact for all of you trivia heads out there. This is the first Detective Comics annual.
Batman had annuals in the same way Superman had annuals, but Action Comics did not until around now. This is when they're like, hey, we can do annuals for everything, so let's do it.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping us.
I wasn't, when I saw Shiva, I'm like, oh, it's Shiva. And then a few pages later, I kind of stopped and went, oh, is this the first appearance of Shiva?
It is not the first appearance of Shiva, but it is her first interaction with any character in the DC universe aside from The Question. Shiva first appeared in Richard Dragon, which was in its own sort of little pockets. It was in the DC universe, but it really wasn't. And that was a Dragon, Shiva, Bronze Tiger role created by Denny O'Neill for a novel that he then sort of adapted into the Richard Dragon series. And Shiva's then first sort of mainstream DCU appearance was the first issue of the Denny O'Neill Question. She'd been in there in that book from the beginning.
Mm. So
this is the first time she meets Batman.
There you go.
And is 3 or 4 months before Death in the Family. So they'll meet again there.
He was worried about Jason.
Yep,
he was.
Yeah, this comes out. The Detective Annual comes out either September or October was the same month as the issue we covered last week with the Todd McFarlane cover of the three cops telling their stories about Batman, which is the issue right before Jason pushes a guy off a roof. So we are right in the run up to Death in the Family when these come out. This would also have been the first, it's the only issue of Detective Comics to ever have a suggested for mature readers on it. And would have probably been the second suggested for mature readers branded Bat book after Killing Joke. So
thankfully they don't do any mature reader Bat books anymore. Those days are long gone.
After the Batwang incident, they decided it's better to be.
Once you peaked, I mean.
I don't know. It was kind of flaccid.
Wah, wah, wah.
So I then take it. I know Will hasn't. Josh, you've never read the Denny O'Neill Question?
A handful of random issues.
Yeah, because Ollie pops up a few times over the course of that series. I love that series. And this is one that the Question Annual is one of the best issues of that series. It sort of sums up a lot of the themes that O'Neill is playing with in that series really well. I was looking at it a few years ago. Comic book writer Fred Van Lente wrote a column about his favorite issues of The Question, because it's one of his favorite series of all time. And it was for like a Denny O'Neill memorial thing. And this was his number one. The Question is a strangely forgotten for a series that's as influential as it is in treating superheroics and superhero comics in a more mature manner without going the Watchmen deconstruction route. But this whole series, this whole storyline sort of pulls both the Batman and the Green Arrow parts into some of the stuff that O'Neill is doing with The Question, because it is a lot of Zen philosophy, a lot of very deeply introspective storytelling. And I will not deny it is a little bit appropriative, but it's not obnoxiously so. At no point are there any awful accents. Osensei is a very tropey character, but it doesn't have the feelings of some of the other stuff we've read that is like, ooh, that's really taking another culture and not treating it with respect.
No, I mean, he's kind of interesting in the sense, you know, the way it starts out with him being Japanese and, you know, this is, yes, there's the tropey honor stuff, but then him taking on and committing to live, staying in China and carrying that man's mission and wholeheartedly adopting that, the culture, the religion, it's a religion of one, you know, I thought was fairly unique or novel spin for the character.
And I thought the structure here was interesting because, you know, until you get to the end of the third issue, these are fairly standalone stories. They are just interwoven as to be able to tell a whole, but you could have also just picked up the, you know, the detective annual and had a fairly, you know, decent standalone story. The Green Arrow especially had a very strong self-contained story. So I thought that was an innovative approach to trying to do this project.
The fact that neither of you had the reference to Shiva or Osensei being Richard Dragon, Kung Fu fighter characters that O'Neill was now working into the DC universe. And it didn't seem like, this is weird. Who are these people?
I did think, because I've seen the Soul of the Dragon animated movie.
Yeah.
But that background on Osensei is not in there. That was all new to me here. But I did recognize the name and from there.
Batman, I think years later, they'll retcon Batman having, of course, trained with him because Batman trains with everybody. But he was, at this point, the master of Richard Dragon, Bronze Tiger, and Shiva.
I have not read Zdarsky's The Night yet, and I've become more and more hesitant in recent weeks of Batman to want to read The Night. Is Osensei one of his many trainers in that?
I don't remember him. There were a lot of mentions of this trainer, mentions of that trainer. And Zdarsky was mostly focusing on new characters, except for Zatara and Ra's. And the Ra's thing was like, let me just bring the Batman Begins stuff and sort of work it into continuity, which invalidates all sorts of other later stories and is a head scratcher. But
I had been meaning to pick up The Night until Joker Year One, and now I am less enthusiastic about
The Knight's definitely better.
Oh, well, way better. Yes, each of these stories stands alone. And it's funny, I just said Ra's. Reading that first annual that has some Talia in it made me go down just a little bit of a research rabbit hole. Because It was like, wait, I wanted to double check something. This is the only second post-crisis appearance of Ra's al Ghul. The first would be Son of the Demon, which was even then ambiguously canon. Ra's would only appear once every year or two, usually briefly, from his first appearance until Rucka and Wade did Evolution and Tower of Babel. Then he became a more regular presence in the Bat books. But before that, anytime Ra's al Ghul showed up, it was a big deal. He was a character that would be often spoken of, but didn't appear a ton.
I'll be honest, with you saying here that this is like the first appearance of Ra's and Talia post-Son of the Demon, it makes this feel very specifically like their next appearance post-Son of the Demon. Like, yes, this is taking from that story. Following up.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to look that up, because I was like, this, if this is coming out around Batman 420 something, Ra's last appearance in Batman, the final pre-crisis Batman story, is Batman 400, which is a Ra's story. So why is Bruce acting so kind of awful to Talia here. And I looked at it, I was like, ah, because this is playing off of the events of Son of the Demon as canon. And it kind of makes sense why he's being such a hard ass.
Baby Damien's out there somewhere.
Yep. Osensei gives each of our heroes a parable or the fable that this story draws its name from. And Bruce's is the monkey who reaches into the gourd, the trap, to get a banana and who can't get his hand out because he's holding the banana, which does make me laugh because there's a whole episode of The Simpsons with Homer and his hands trapped in two vending machines and he just has to let go of the stuff. But it is a very apt analogy for who Bruce is, because at any point he could just let go of his crusade and escape and live a happy life, and he just won't, because that's who he is. And this is a strangely homicidal and diabolical penguin.
And maybe gay?
Yeah, there's definitely a more than coded, not completely subtext here about Penguin having no problem wiping out all the women in Gotham and possibly the world.
But boss, then there'll only be guys left. Fine by me.
Wah, wah, wah.
And I think as we discussed when we were talking about the Penguin affair, this is that same period where writers really didn't know what to do with the Penguin. And here it felt like, okay, we're going to try to make him more of a in line with your Jokers and your Two Faces. And it never quite flies with Penguin. Making him
well, penguins don't fly.
Ba-dum-bum.
Ah.
But I think making him a mob boss works so much better than making him a homicidal supervillain.
Gay Penguin kind of works for me. Like, thinking about, and I don't remember, I had never finished Gotham. I don't remember if he's explicitly gay or just as queer-coded as fucking possible.
The actor who plays him is a gay man. He basically said he played him as gay.
He's clearly playing him as gay, whether they wanted him to or not.
Right.
That works for me a lot better than when we get these stories where it's like, oh, Penguin has 11 illegitimate children. He's been banging Strange all over Gotham. And it's like, really?
The only answer I have to that is overcompensation. That is him being in the closet and overcompensating because, no, I'm straight. Look at all my illegitimate children. Wah.
Wah. Flipper penis. Wah.
I think Flipper Penis has to be the name of the episode.
I think so. Could be worse. I could have blood gushing from my nose. And not our last weird virus of the night, but we'll get there in a few minutes. And then Green Arrow's story. This is in the middle of the Grell, the Mike Grell Green Arrow run. I think this is the first time Denny has written Oliver since, you know, the GLGA days. I mean, maybe a random issue here or there, like a guest shot somewhere. But it's nice to see the feel he has for the character still. And you'd know this better than I would, Josh. We've seen Oliver get the yips since.
Oh, I have this in my notes. Ollie getting the yips here. And it being written by Denny O'Neill makes Ollie getting the yips in that really bad Arrow in the Bat that we read even fucking dumber.
Yes, because this is so much better version of Ollie gets the yips.
Because now that was like one of your redeeming qualities. Like when we did that episode, you know, you're like, well, like that's an interesting story. There's something you could have, you know, like I like, you know, that as a, you know, as a plot point. I like it a lot less as a recycled plot point done a lot more poorly than a story by the exact same writer 20 years earlier.
Let me explain the yips for the benefit of the listeners who aren't familiar with this concept. We usually hear it in sports. It's where, for whatever reason, when a play should be absolutely normal and mundane, and yet it becomes a block for an athlete. The example I always think of, Chuck Knoblauch, the second baseman for the New York Yankees, got to a point in his career where he could no longer reliably make the throw from second base to first base. He was absolutely physically fine, but it became a mental issue for him. So what we have in this story is Oliver loses his confidence and his aim as he is being challenged by this evil, villainous archer in what can't be the only Green Arrow story in which he is challenged by a rival archer.
Most definitely not.
How many evil archers? Merlin, his arch nemesis, is an evil archer.
There are multiple one-off The Greatest Archer who has to challenge Ollie that we've never heard of and will never see again. I feel like it's a tried and true that, like, every writer who gets a run has to put one in there somewhere.
Because it's like an Old West cowboy gun, dueling showdown type thing. Like, some guy rides into town looking to take on the biggest and the baddest.
One of my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone is about the legendary pool player who can't rest because his spirit keeps getting summoned back by people who want to challenge him. And he's finally beaten. In the end, he's like, oh, thank God. Now it's your turn. I can finally rest.
And of course, we get the classic quote, there was time now, all the time in the world.
That is my favorite Twilight Zone of all time.
Well, of course.
Yes, that's my life. That is my life. You look around my house, you look at the stacks of books, and it's like, someday there'll be time.
Hey, Matt, one of these days, you're going to have them organized. You're going to know where to find them, right?
You'll see me recording with that as the background, and on that day, I'll finally know peace.
So let me ask you, are either of you familiar with this device known as a modem?
Oh, shit.
I have referenced that on this show before as an example, and it is not the only time that happens in the question, but this is definitely because there's an earlier issue where Aristotle taught his tech guy explains the modem to Vic. And here you got Vic explaining it to Shiva, and it's in the Detective Comics annual. And it just, every time I read it, it just makes me chuckle because this was 1988. You did actually have to explain to people what a modem was. I remember reading a Hardy Boys book written, one of the ones written at this period, and them explaining what a modem was in it. And me being like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if I'll ever have one of those.
You have a message from the human brain, Master Bruce. Or the... I fucked it up. The robot brain, Master Bruce.
I love it. 35 years, and now it's ubiquitous. It's funny. And then the final story, the question annual, is the three heroes, warriors, as Shiva specifically calls them. As I don't think we've said, Shiva is traveling with Osensei and is sort of serving as his bodyguard because he's not willing to fight at this point, as he's 150 years old and has just decided it's his time. But it's now the three warriors helping to bring Osensei to be laid to rest with his wife.
Except for Batman, who says, Vic asks him, hey, I feel kind of useless with you around. Could you just not be around? And Batman's like, sure, why not? I'll just
give you all the money that you need, get your planes, get your boats.
I like the dynamic between the three of them together was short-lived, but it worked. I love the Batman is 96% detective.
I loved that. I loved
that. Was great.
And Ollie's being snotty, like, oh, I thought all you did was swing from rooftops and beat on the poor. That's only 4% of what I do.
It really kind of reframed the first two issues because, like Will said earlier, you're reading the first two and it's like, oh, this is just going to be like one of these annuals where everyone's a standalone issue and they're just kind of like have the same thing on the cover. Because the first issue is, them interacting with Batman and ultimately like he owes them a favor at the end. And then same thing with Green Arrow and he has his own standalone. But the third one brings them all together with it and ties it in, makes the first two feel more part of the whole than they did on first reading, which worked.
And thematically, it starts with a little bit of a question solo story where a thug from the first arc of the Question series, the first four issues, comes back, and basically Vic fails and Shiva has to save him again, because that is how the first issue of the Question ends, with Shiva pretty much beating him to death. And then issue two opens with her having saved him and brought him to Richard Dragon to train. But he fails. And then throughout the issue, he's now got this chip on his shoulder, isn't the right word, but something hanging over him. And he feels like he needs to succeed. And that is the arc of Denny O'Neill's Question as a series. Is Vic sort of going inside and struggling with his feelings of inadequacy, his rage, and trying to be Zen and not really succeeding. But the end of the issue, I love the last couple pages where they're on the boat and they're going to the island where Osensei's wife is supposed to be buried, and the boat overturns in a storm and Osensei is lost. And Vic feels again like he failed. But he gets back and Tot, Aristotle Roeder, his father figure, has gotten a letter from Gotham. And it just says, did research. When the family's bodies were being moved, one body was lost. It was Osensei's wife. She is now buried at sea. Vic, realizing that Osensei drowning and going down means that they are indeed buried together, and Vic saying, maybe there's no such thing as a failure, is this really profound thought. And Osensei's fable to him are words delivered as Vic is trying to save him about identity. And I was once like you, if you live, you will change. Some parables are silent. Denny O'Neill's Question is deeply philosophical. And it's one of the reasons I love the series, because it is not something you see in superhero comics.
Yeah, I have in my notes for the final story that it is definitely Denny after he lost his fastball. But particularly the ending and the way this all tied up here was very clever, poetic. It ended stronger than I thought it would, right? So by the end of issue two, you know, my thinking of like, where's this going to rank or how strong is this story went way up by the end of issue three.
The question, to use your analogy there, if Denny O'Neill was at, you know, the peak of his fastball in Hard Traveling Heroes and the O'Neill Adams Batman run, the question is Denny having learned to throw a screwball and just doing a completely different pitch. And it's being equally amazing, but in a very different way.
Trying to think if that sports analogy holds, Matt.
Yeah, the arrow in the bat is him being a musician coming out for the first pitch that throws it in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Oh. Wah, wah. Don't stand all the way at the top of the mound, right? You can stand at the bottom. You don't even have to stand on the mound, right? You don't have to.
Batman has a cameo in that first arc of the question, which allows it to be covered. And I would love to someday do the first four issues of the question. I actually have a possible spot for it too, but it is such a different comic than anything else I've read of O'Neill's. Now, granted, I mean, I haven't read everything Denny O'Neill has written. That is a vast body of work. I haven't read Richard Dragon, which they released in a hardcover, and is now on Infinite. So I might have to read that at some point in an omnibus. It'll be easier to read it on Infinite than it is to read an omnibus, because those things are unwieldy, you say.
They just look pretty on shelves.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think I've talked my way through this one.
Two last notes.
Yes, and I do have one other thing, but
Penguin physically getting the better of Talia by like smacking her hand with the umbrella or whatever just made me groan out loud. Like, fuck off with that one. And they mention Ollie's chili recipe, which I will say there's a JLA secret files where they print Green Arrow's chili recipe. And the amount of pepper they put in it is insane. But if you cut it in half, it's fantastic. I've made it a number of times. And it's the Green Arrow recipe from Secret Files is legit good.
And just, I guess, one other comment that has occurred to me because we haven't talked about it. The art, the Green Arrow issue just is so stylistically different from the flanking issues. It does seem a little out of place artistically. Because you got Klaus Janson on the detective and Dennis Cowan and Rick Magyar, who were the creative team on The Question, on The Question annual. Tom Artis has a much lighter, less gritty style than either of those guys.
Klaus Janson's a fucking legend. Like, oh, yeah. I mean, the first one, you shouldn't have to compete with that.
No. And man, Cowan... I think of the 38 issues of The Question, 36 regular and two annuals, I'm pretty sure Cowan does 34 to 36 of them. I think he misses one or two in there. And they're all just stunning. I mean, this is a guy, he was one of the Milestone founders after this. I think he did the original, I know he did... Hardware. I think he also might have been the... No, it was Jean-Paul Leon who was the first artist on Static. But he did a lot of the designs for Milestone too, and is still involved with them to today. So another legend. And then you've got this guy in the middle. It is unfair to be flanked by Janson and Cowan.
I believe that means it's time. But Fables on the big board!
We'll have a little discussion here. For me, I think this definitely falls above 200 for me, somewhere between one and 200. I'm just not 100% sure where within that range.
I'd put it above Blue Wall at 167.
That's funny. I was about to say I would put it above Jason and Croc at 166. That was where I was looking. So yeah.
Will, there's an Anarchy story at 150.
But that is the first and the best Anarchy story. That is a character with problems with diminishing returns on Anarchy.
My ceiling would be the recent You Should Have Seen Him, Batman 423 at 130. So between 130 and 167.
I think between 130 and 140, I would put this above Killing Joke.
I like Foreign Bodies better, though. Foreign Bodies, if y'all thought we were a little soft on Foreign Bodies, because Will had Justice League fatigue, but Foreign Bodies is good.
Man, you know what? When you put me in the cold ground, that is as good an epitaph as anything. Justice League fatigue.
So then I can accept that. So that then puts us between 140 and 132. I think, actually, all right, I'm going to throw out a number.
Okay.
136 below the first Joe Chill story, but above the Matt Wagner Trinity, which, as much as I like it, has some problematic elements.
Yeah. All right. 136.
All right.
A very respectable showing.
Yeah. You know, Josh, we almost made it through an episode of yours without something that was going to make us go, why did we read this again?
Which one of us was responsible for this one? It might have been me.
It wasn't me.
It was a 50-50.
It's Will's fault.
You had it listed as one of the possibilities. I did. I picked it rather than a couple of other stories that would have wound up being better.
What did I say here? I said Fables, and yeah, I wanted to do Antiques Roadshow. I wanted to do the Judd Winnick one where Bruce and Ollie getting to bid in wars on eBay.
Yes.
Look, we just read some Judd Winnick. It was not good. I don't think I want to read any more.
Judd Winnick's Green Arrow is much, much better.
It is. And I'll say it again. There's so much good in Under the Hood, but it is spoiled by the fact that it tied so deeply in Infinite Crisis that every third page is, oh, by the way, here's an OMAC. Oh, here's the Secret Society. Oh, remember Identity Crisis?
I think the best proof of that is how good the animated movie is.
And that's
when you clean it up and take that stuff out, it's such a good animated movie.
That will be the March bonus episode. So we will, because I agree. I think that the problem with Under the Hood, and we said it in the episode, is that it is so padded with all the other stuff going on in the DC universe that it moves away from the heart of what the story should have been, which is Bruce and Jason and Joker.
Oh, so, and this is a little bonus, but an hour or so into the show, for you Patreon backers, right? In our bonus episodes, we will now start tracking episodes of the Harley Quinn series. We will have a little running Harley Quinn board, because as Matt quickly realized, I love the show so much that if we continue to watch it, like, the top half of little board is going to be nothing but Harley Quinn. So he's like, no, we're going to sequester it.
Yes, we will now be having every month, we will be covering one or two episodes of Harley Quinn on top of whatever else we're covering. So we can have a second board, and we'll have an excuse to watch the, not that he needs an excuse, but, you know, an additional motivation to keep watching the show. But we're discussing this because we really don't want to get into the next story, but we got to do the final story of the night, which is Batman, Green Arrow, Poison Tomorrow. The writer is Denny O'Neill, with pencils by Mike Netzer, inks by Joe Rubenstein, colors by Laverne Kandzierski, letters by Todd Klein, and edited by Archie Goodwin and Bill Kaplan. The cover date is December of 1992. Green Arrow comes to Gotham looking for a man who infected Black Canary with a mysterious illness, a man that Batman has found. But his death leaves the two heroes with more questions than answers. Questions that will lead to the person behind the virus, Poison Ivy. So yeah, we got a early 90s prestige format one shot here. Oh, and we didn't mention it before, but by the way, if you want to read Fables, parts 1 and 3 are available on Infinite. Part 2 is not.
No.
Nor is Poison Tomorrow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got
Poison Tomorrow, I think, is kept off internet for the good of, like, they're keeping it off Infinite as a public service.
Yeah.
And it started off kind of promising. We're like, on page 2, we get a Man Who Shot Liberty Valance reference, which is just a classic fucking movie and made me smile. And it was the last time I fucking smiled until I put this comic back in its bag.
Yeah. But at least there's that whole sequence of basically Batman calling Green Arrow an idiot. That was kind of fun. Like, can't you see? Can't you put these pieces together? There's this truck full of baby food speeding down the highway. We had a crazy guy smashing jars of baby food. Can't you see what this means? He's Ollie, like, are you a moron?
He's like Jason from The Good Place, like, where everyone has to wait for like an extra 10 seconds for him to be like, oh my god, like,
baby food.
It's insulting. The art is
a
choice. It's really weird. But the posing of Poison Ivy and what they do with her character, like, there's cheesecake, and then there's literally just having her lying on her back with her legs in the air as men come in. Like, it's rough.
And we are at the point in Ivy's evolution where she's beginning to start the evolution towards eco-terrorist Ivy.
Well, she's an eco-terrorist in this one.
Yeah, but there's still a lot of the sexpot seductress Ivy, which is what she was full stop, without really the eco-terrorism, until Secret Origins by Neil Gaiman that started connecting her more with the green. Because before that, she was just we read it in her first appearance where she's just, you know, oh, I seduce men. That's what I do.
Here she fucks Jude's to death. That was a choice that was made by Denny O'Neill.
Yeah.
Makes me sad.
And 92, Denny still has, you know, this is not too long after Venom. He still has the beginning of Azrael, the first 50 issues of Azrael, which are really quite good. It's just every now and then you're starting to see him, you know, he swings and he misses every now and then. And listen, I've always said, even the best creators have one or two bad stories in them. And in the same way that even a bad creator every now and then can come up with a story where it's like, wow, that was actually really good. I can't believe that was written by insert writer here. But this is definitely a not good story. And our other villain here is such a central casting, motiveless villain. I mean, this guy is willing to kill children, many, many children, for money. And you know what? Listen, we live in a world of...
He's a Republican.
But they try to put on a better face. This guy's like, yeah.
But he's such a weirdo, right? He's got what I read as a Southern accent.
Oh, yeah.
His kids are basically just set up as the punchline for the story. That's the only reason why they're in the story, just so we can have this twist ending.
Which I fucking hate.
Well, you know, kids dying for no reason. That's kind of fun. He inexplicably decides to turn on Poison Ivy and just, you know, to blow up her diseased mansion.
And Ivy's whole thing is that once she gets in contact with you, she can mind control you. Why isn't she mind controlling this guy into not blowing her up?
Isn't that what we thought she was doing when she just had sex with him for no reason?
Yeah, exactly. I figured that this whole thing was to get him to be under her spell, but he was under her spell, but in the, you know, film noir, femme fatale, power of my feminine wiles way, not in the, her whole shtick is she mind controls people when she touches them, and then they die eventually. But they're still mind controlled until they die.
I mean, okay, there's lots of problems. One of these is, this is Grell era Green Arrow, where Ollie kills a lot of fucking people, like a lot of people. Pick up any of the Shadow issues and they just bodies on top of just mountains of bodies piling up. And he's putting arrows through dudes here and Batman doesn't really care. Batman takes a truck off a bridge and is like, that dude's probably dead.
I hope he's
go back and find Ollie.
I'm not going to check on it. I got stuff to do.
And yes, the ending, there's that bit in the first season of the Audio Adventures with a Joker story that ends pretty much the same way this one does. But there it's the Joker. He's screwing with a guy who pissed him off and he poisons the guy's kids. And it's terrible and it's horrible and it is absolutely chilling. But it's a Joker story. Here, in the end, they figure out that bone marrow from the people who are immune to this plague can be used through bone marrow grafts, grant the immunity to people who've been infected. So that's how we save Oliver, and that's how we save Dinah.
Bruce shows up to the bad guy and is like, fuck your kids.
Yeah. It's like, don't tell me this 7-foot-tall monstrosity, it required all of his bone marrow to save those two. This guy's got like 4 small children under the age of 10. And Bruce is like, oh, well, you shouldn't have been a shitheel. If you hadn't been a shitheel, your kids would be alive.
And then you couldn't just take the bone marrow from Dinah and Ollie and give it to the kids?
But that wouldn't give you this final splash page of Fenn on his knees weeping about his children.
No!
I finally watched, you know, a movie that is very highly regarded, Sicario, last week, which also has a "we're gonna kill the kids" at the end scene. Spoiler for a 10-year-old movie. Maybe it's just where I'm at in my life with 9 and 11-year-old boys, but those
proud backers of the show.
Proud backers of the show. Those scenes don't work for me. Like, it didn't work for me in Sicario, which is a much, much better product than Poison Tomorrow. And it definitely didn't work for me at the end of Poison Tomorrow.
And Ivy's whole thing here is, I want to release this plague and it's going to wipe out most of humanity. I'm going to pull the stand and the survivors will make a new society. Except that's what Ra's al Ghul has been saying at this point for like 20 years.
This is the plot of many Ra's al Ghul stories.
Yeah. And this is the plot of Contagion and Legacy a few years later, only better there.
I mean, it's so much more heavy-handed than the last Denny O'Neill story we just read. Like, I have in my notes, subtext is for cowards.
Yeah, there is definitely zero subtext in this story. This is just such an on-the-nose. And, you know, the big guy who's Ivy's little servant, it's like, wait, is she mind-controlling him? Or is he just, again, controlled by her feminine wiles?
And the name Jason, is he supposed to be, what is it, Floronic Man?
Jason Woodrow. I don't think he is, but it just feels like, why are you using that name?
Like, as like the only other person with this thing that she's found, that she knows, and name Jason. I wasn't sure if that was supposed to be like a call on or...
Yeah, it just seemed like a weird choice.
Because then it's a really weird way to portray that character who, you know, is a major Swamp Thing character.
Yeah, no, I think that was just Denny O'Neill. Like, let me think of a name for this character. I'm going to call him Jason. And then having that name in the back of his head connected to Ivy and not thinking that, oh, right, that's because that was the name of the guy who created her. Played by John Glover in Batman and Robin.
Love John Glover.
Oh, yeah.
My dad drew his blood once.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a kernel of a good idea here. Yeah. But the execution on it is just poor all over the place. And the idea of Ivy manipulating a pharma bro makes perfect sense and would be a great story now.
Oh my God. Like, and I know that this was written too early for it to be, but if the bad guy was Martin Shkreli, it would have been better.
Oh yeah. Sitting there listening to his Wu-Tang album and Poison Ivy mind controlling him. Just go.
And when like the end, she gets him to kill himself by basically eating his own Johnson. That'd be the perfect way for him to go out.
After putting that Wu-Tang album up on the internet for everyone to listen to.
Yes.
I think we've covered so many of my notes on this because it's just a lot of just mess. And
one thought that just briefly popped into my mind. This doesn't really feel like it serves Green Arrow all that well. He is facing a bat villain and doesn't really have a place in this story.
This is also, I think, where timeline-wise, we're getting near the end of the Mike Grell era. And yep. So as that, he is, in the Mike Grell books, he is unwinding. Now, he doesn't become dumber, but he is making bad choice after bad choice. He is giving himself lots of stuff to have to try to redeem himself for when Kevin Smith brings him back, you know, a decade later. And there is some of that in here. Like, he is digging his hole.
Yeah, because if this is 92, Zero Hour is the end of 94, and Grell's run ended about a year before, because Dixon does the arc that runs up to Zero Hour. So I think, yeah, we're probably right around the end of, we're probably within 6 months to a year, the end of the Grell run.
But when did he sleep with the girl that was working in the florist shop? Oh. I don't think we're there yet. But Ollie, we might be right around there. He's got a big Shado run, which I think might be like his last fine moment in the mid-60s. And then I think, so that's like August of 92. I just pulled up on the Wikia, like issue 65 at random.
Well, so this is December of 92.
Yeah, so maybe we go ahead a couple months. When was Fables?
88.
Okay.
Yeah, that was September, October of 88.
The Wikia just gave me a weird random image. Yeah, I think it's all fallen apart for him. By the time we hit the 70s, it's all fallen apart for Ollie.
And then Dixon, I think, takes over at 80, doesn't he? Right around 80, 81?
81 is the first issue. You have the 10 of Crossroads, and then, yeah, it's all bad. 81 to 99 are not great. Probably the second worst stretch of Green Arrow pre-New 52, aside from what J.T. Krull did at the end, which is the absolute abomination.
I mean, I liked the Zero issue, but that's because Connor. But I think, yeah, there's a lot of real mess in, and I like the Connor stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think they hold up on their own a little better, but if you finish the Grell run and then go into them, the writing and style and the characterization are such a huge drop-off change that you're just like, what the hell is happening here? Like, it should have been a volume one of a new series and not issue 81 of the continuing.
Because they were trying to move it back into the DC universe. It was no longer a mature reader's book. And they were getting Ollie set to, you know, factor into Zero Hour and things. So, yeah. Oh, boy, we have really wandered. We've become a Green Arrow podcast for a minute or two there. But better than talking about this comic.
Yes. Ooh. Yes. Ollie sleeping with Marianne, the girl who works with his wife. I'm just going to call her his wife. She's not his wife yet, but at the flower shop where they live. Not good, but I mean, that's Oliver Queen. Like, Oliver Queen is going to make, like, he's going to be three steps forward, one step back if you're reading an Ollie run. Like, he's going to fuck up and then have to own it. That is part of his character. And that was one of the big ones. Whereas this, he actually did it. Like, I don't know. One of the reasons why I was bringing the Marianne thing up actually relating to this book is the whole will he or won't he, like, oh, she's so hot, should I have sex with Poison Ivy because she's trying to sex him to death, and then he doesn't because he loves Dinah so much.
No.
Even though I think this is around the exact same time that he's decides to stick it in the girl working at the florist. So,
but you know, does he do this only because Batman warned him against it? Like, yo bro,
no, because if we're gonna really characterize them, if Bruce tells Ollie not to do something, he absolutely will have to fucking do it.
Oh, yeah.
Bro, she's going to want to smash. But, like, look, you don't smash, right? Because she's crazy. She's crazy, bro. Don't do it.
Okay. I think we've covered this as much as we're willing.
Oof. It's time. But Batman, Green Arrow, Poison Tomorrow, smash today on the big board. Above 350?
You like it better than Gotham by Gaslight? Gotham by Gaslight's at 356.
That does have a shit-ass Batman, right? He's like, oh, maybe I don't need to be Batman anymore. Mm.
There's a lot of bad books at this part of the list.
Yeah. It's the poopy end. We put the poopy books down here.
See, I like the Grounded, the one that we covered my first time here, 362, even though you got, like, that doesn't feel like it belongs around Dark Multiverse Hush and Robin and Batman and The Wedding, which is only this low because of the really bad Booster Gold story. And But there's some.
Tell you what. You pay off the wedding, even with the booster gold, you probably don't wind up at 358. That's what you get for not having a fucking wedding.
That's fair.
Well, okay. Is this better or worse than Arrow and the Bat at 345?
I feel worse. Because at least 345, it was entertaining to watch Ollie and Bruce squabble. Like, that was kind of fun. It got real tiresome, but it was fun for a bit. This is just tedious.
Hold on. I'm going to scroll down to my notes. I don't remember anything in Arrow and the Bat, like, making me cringe or be as...
There's that one...
Upset as this. There might be, because it was not good.
Yeah, there was that one character who's the prime minister of the fictional nation who speaks in broken English, despite it turning out that he was a Gotham con artist. So he grew up in America, and he's putting on this accent, apparently. That was not good.
General Joe, yeah, that was bad. No, nothing as bad as Ivy just laying on her back with her legs up in the air for dudes to come get sex to death, and Batman taking joy in the death of innocent children at the end.
There's the deal breaker right there. The Batman reveling in his foes.
So to me, that sour note does smack of something like Dawnbreaker at 368 or Earth 1 Volume 1 at 371.
Well, right below that is Widening Gyre, which I know Will has some very strong opinions on.
And the thing, again, I think we find with Widening Gyre is if Widening Gyre had ended at issue 5, it would probably be around like 300. It's just that last issue... It's like with Batman smacking Silver St. Cloud around and then her being fridged, that pulls that down into the bottom 10 territory.
Yeah.
Not in the bottom 10 anymore.
You're right. Just outside the bottom 10. Thank you, War Crimes.
Okay, we can work our way up. It's better than Mad.
Yes. It's better than Dark Allegiances, because nowhere in here does Batman go to a party with Hitler.
No Hitler.
That's a good point. No Hitler in this book.
But, okay, so everyone has to start somewhere. That Red Hood origin with Jason Todd's dad having sex with Jason Todd's underage mother behind a dumpster.
Yeah, that's
bad.
We're in the right territory. We've found this
zone. Batman versus the Undead is dumb, but it is not as problematic as Batman and Superman and Batman versus Vampires and Werewolves. A little below it, it's still got problematic elements. I think we're between 377. It's either going to be 75, 76, or 77. It's just where it falls in relation to Everyone Has to Start Somewhere, and stop me if you've heard this one.
I'd probably put it at 376.
Okay, so in between.
That's what I was thinking.
Stop me if you've heard this one and Everyone Has to Start Somewhere. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Nice work as usual, Josh.
Well, that's the reason that's why next time Josh is going to take us up on the challenge, coming at us with 3 books that, and he's going to try to get us to have at least one that is going to fall in the top 50, right, Josh?
3 swings at the top 50 next time.
Okay.
I put Will through enough pain at this point. Not always intentionally, sometimes intentionally, but not always.
If you didn't have a household full of loyal backers, you'd be in trouble.
This book is so forgettable. I mean, I probably read it when it first came out, and I didn't remember how bad it was. It's like, wait, it's Batman Green Arrow, it's Denny O'Neill? How bad could this be?
I stumbled upon it. Well, similarly to Arrow and the Bat, I stumbled on it at my LCS. They had gotten it in like a collection, and I think they were still sorting through and putting stuff away, and I saw it on the counter, and I'm like, don't even walk it over to the long box. Like, Batman, Green Arrow, Denny O'Neil, prestige format. I'm like, I'd never fucking heard of this, but it's mine. I hadn't read it yet, but it's why I threw it in for the part two list. And I don't tap out of stories often, but like, if I wouldn't have finished this if we weren't recording this week. I would have tapped out about 50-60% of the way through. And it didn't get better.
No. Well, Josh, thank you as ever for coming on the show.
Pleasure as always.
Always appreciate you coming on. We appreciate your support. Next week, another of our backers, John Wickham, is coming back. And we're talking three more first meetings between Batman and Superman, because they have met for the first time no less than 7 or 8 times. We'll see if these come out any better than the last batch. We can only hope. We'd like to thank our Patreon backers, Dan Grote, Josh Wheel.
Thank you, guys. Hey, this guy!
Mrs. Abigail Hartbaum. Asimov Fangirl, Tony Thornley.
Go Utes!
Sam Hopper, John Wickham, Robert Secundus.
Bobby Two Bucks.
Tim Rooney, Giorgio Sereggioli, David Wheel, Alexander Wheel, Matt McThorne,
McThorny,
Dan Offer,
barely knew her,
and Nate Randell for their support. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at BatChat Comics, and the show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music /Audible, and on ComicsXF.com, where new episodes drop every Thursday. You can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/BatChatWithMattAndWill. Where you can get shout-outs, bonus content, pick a story, and even come on the show. If you want to hear more of my ramblings, mostly about the three C's, comics, cinema, and cats, you can follow me on Twitter at MattLaz1013.
And I'm at Will Nevin. I'm never leaving Twitter, but I'm leaving this show. Good night, St. Louis!
And be sure to visit ComicsXF at ComicsXF.com or ComicsXF on Blue Sky for our weekly Friday Bat Chat roundup of new Bat books. For my other show, WMQ&A, where my longtime best friend, Dan Grote, and I interview comics creators, retailers, publishers, journalists, and other related tradespeople, as well as all the other stuff Will and I are writing. And stay safe out there, folks. Gotham is not a place to be after dark.